Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Margaret Flowers of Physicians for a National Health Program on the growth in the uninsured population, the evolution of Obamacare, the fate of Medicare at the hands of budget cutters, and what's up with the single-payer movement. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Maria Armudian, author of Kill the Messenger, on the media's role in genocide and other horrors. Before that, just a few words in the news. On Tuesday, the Census Bureau released its annual income and poverty and health insurance numbers. They show incomes down, poverty up, and a record 50 million without health insurance for the entire year. I should say that these numbers are derived from a special survey of about 60,000 households taken in the March of every year. The right wing hates this and similar data-gathering exercises as invasions of privacy, and unconstitutional, they say, since that sacred document only authorizes a count of the population every 10 years. I suspect the real reason they hate these surveys is because they provide a pretty good picture of how messed up life in the USA really is, and they'd just rather not know, or at least rather we didn't know. Not, of course, that all that many people pay attention. Okay, first income. The median household, that is, the one smack in the middle of the distribution, with half of all households above it and half of all households below, saw its income fall by 2.3% after inflation last year. That's not the biggest decline in the 43 years that the Bureau has been collecting these numbers. That honor belongs to 2008, when it was down by 3.6%. But this is the third consecutive year of decline. Those declines, following a streak of declines early in the decade and very weak gains between 2005 and 2007, have brought the median income to more than 7% below where it was in 1999, its all-time peak year. In fact, we've only seen a growth in median income in 3 of the 11 years since 2000. These household numbers only begin in 1967. A Census Bureau reports data for families starting in 1947. Although the trends are similar, people who live in families, about 80% of us, generally have higher incomes than the 20% of those of us who don't. But we have to use the family numbers if we want longer-term comparisons. Those tell us that over the last decade, median family income is down about 6%, a little less than household income. The only other 10-year period that saw a decline was one ending in 1983, after the deep early 1980s recession, but that decline was half as sharp as the current one and was quickly reversed. That's not likely to happen this time. And the change from the golden age is remarkable. From the late 1950s through the mid-1970s, the average 10-year gain in family income was 35%, as opposed to the recent 6% decline. If we'd been experiencing these sorts of gains recently, the average family would be pulling in almost $87,000 instead of just over $60,000 a year. In other words, almost half again as much. This is a remarkable change for a society supposedly based on universal upward mobility. Of course, many things happened beneath the surface of those headline averages. The average income of the poorest 20% of households fell by 6%, about three times as much as the average. After correcting it for inflation, that poorest quintile now has a lower income than it did in 1973. The richest 20%, though, was down by just 2% last year. Its income is 44% above where it was in 1973. Looked at another way, over the last 10 years, 2% of the benefits of economic growth have gone to the poorest 20% of the population. Just over half have gone to the top 20%. And because of the way that this survey is conducted and reported, very rich people, for example, can't be bothered with census questionnaires. The upper end is grossly underrepresented by this report. So things are even more lopsided than these numbers suggest. For black households, the news was unsurprisingly worse. Average incomes were down in line with the average, but since the 1999 peak, they're down 12%, considerably more than the average. The tight labor markets of the 1990s were good for black incomes. Average household incomes for the black population rose from 58% of the white average in 1990 to 65% in 2000, a rise of 7 percentage points. But now they're back down to 59%, almost erasing all of those gains. But here, too, averages can obscure important differences. While the poorest 20% of black households are slightly worse off than they were in 1982, the top 20% have seen their incomes rise 43%, and the top 5%'s incomes have gone up by 61%. Hispanic households took a somewhat smaller than average hit last year, and their median income is down only 6% over the last decade. Only. These things are relative. Overall, the U.S. income distribution remains very close to the most unequal it's been since the 1929 crash. Figures for poverty are pretty similar. The official poverty rate rose from 14.3% of the population in 2009 to 15.1% last year. That's the highest level since 1993, an immediate post-recession year, as was the previous peak in 1983. These levels are 3 to 5 points higher than they were in the late 1990s and late 1960s. That might not sound as bad as it actually is because of the way the poverty rate is computed. A line was set in the early 1960s such that households with incomes under that level were considered poor. That line has simply been adjusted for inflation ever since, even though average incomes have nearly doubled. In other words, someone with a poverty line income today has exactly the same purchasing power as someone with a similar income 50 years ago. In the trade, this is known as an absolute standard of poverty. Most people who research these things prefer a relative definition of poverty. So typically, they define a poor household as one with income less than half of the average. Surveys have shown that's the way people experience poverty, too. They define it relative to their neighbors and not by some standard set by a group of now-forgotten bureaucrats 5 decades ago. Were our poverty rate calculated by a relative standard, it would be between 20 and 25%, 5 to 10 points higher than it is now. And today's poor are poorer than they've been in the past. Close to half, 44% of the poor, have incomes less than half the poverty line. That's the highest share on record. In sum, what this means is that, by official definitions, 1 in 6 people in this very rich country are officially poor, and by a more humane and reasonable definition, 1 in 4 of us is poor. And the number of people without health insurance rose by over 1 million last year to just shy of 50 million, 16% of the population, or 1 out of 6. Again, the story is more complex under that average. More than 1 in 5 young adults, those between 18 and 34, were uninsured last year. The share of uninsured older but non-elderly adults was somewhat smaller. But thanks to Medicare, only 2% of those over 65 were uninsured, though if our rulers have their way, Medicare is going to get a lot stingier in the coming years. The numbers of uninsured were, of course, worse, considerably worse, if you were black or Hispanic. And these figures for the uninsured mean uncovered for the entire year. Another quarter or so of the population probably had a spell of a month or more without health insurance. What a country. Finally, things just get worse for Obama and the Democrats. To lose an election to a Republican in New York City, as happened this past Tuesday, is almost unheard of. Politico.com reported that a bunch of Democratic strategists and funders were furious at the president after that loss. Lately, it's been striking me how Obama has actually been worse than he had to be. He's governed to the right of both party elites and their funders. That is a failure of a profound sort. Back after a musical break to hear about the healthcare mess. This song's dedicated to B. Obama.
And I'll drown here trying to get up for some air. But each time I think I breathe, I'm laid on with a double share of the punishing burden. Don't deserve to be down here, but I'll never leave. And I've learned one thing, you can't escape the beast in the null and void in a failure.
That was some of Failure by Swans, like Messiah and Götterdämmerung, never with a definite article. My first guest is Margaret Flowers, Congressional Fellow with Physicians for a National Health Program. PNHP is an 18,000-member organization, mostly doctors, advocating for a single-payer health insurance system. Aside from their agitational efforts, they're a wonderful source of information on the idiocies of the current setup. Flowers is a pediatrician who's currently given up practicing medicine for full-time advocacy. Margaret Flowers. Welcome, Margaret Flowers. First, to start with, any reactions to the news that the number of uninsured now is just a hair short of 50 million?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I mean, we now have another 1 million people who are newly uninsured. These people are primarily people in the workforce who have not able to afford insurance, those between the ages of 35 and 64. And as we know, the lack of insurance is directly related to increased preventable deaths. Sorry that we haven't addressed our fundamental problems with healthcare in the United States yet.
It wasn't just that people are losing their jobs. They're working jobs where they're just not offered the benefits, or their employers are cutting back on the coverage.
Right. We've seen a steady decline in the number of people who are able to either have access to employer-sponsored health insurance or are able to afford their employer benefit plans. And we saw a continued decline in that over the last year. This is the 11th year that we've seen a decline in those numbers.
And when Michael Moore made Sicko, he decided to focus on people with insurance rather than the uninsured. I'm gathering that the situation of the people with insurance has gotten even worse over the last several years.
Right. What we're seeing in people who have insurance is that we consider them to be, more and more of them to be, what we call underinsured, where they are paying for insurance premiums, but their copays and deductibles are so high, or the coinsurance or the amount of benefits that are covered are not adequate. So they end up, if they have a serious accident or illness, being very financially vulnerable, at risk for bankruptcy. We know that medical conditions are the greatest, medical costs are the greatest cause of personal bankruptcy, and that the majority, about 80% of those people, had health insurance but still went bankrupt. So, it's not just the uninsured that are having difficulty. It's those who have insurance, and many of them are self-rationing care. They're not able to afford care, so they're cutting back on it themselves.
Polls used to show that people were more or less satisfied with their own personal health insurance coverage if they had insurance. Is that still true?
Well, I haven't seen recent polls on that, but if you think about it, we know that at any given time, about 80% of the population is healthy. So 80% of people who are healthy, who have health insurance, may feel that they're adequately covered. What we find is that when people actually do encounter health problems, a serious illness or an accident, that's when they realize how difficult it is to get care in this situation and how difficult it is to afford care.
So the best health insurance is when you don't use it.
Exactly. And that's what the health insurers like too. They try to ensure that healthy population that doesn't have much in the way of medical cost each year.
Now, in the run-up to Obamacare taking full effect over the next couple of years, it does seem that insurers are wasting no time raising rates. What's happening with the cost of insurance?
Right, we're continuing to see. We've seen steady increases in the cost of insurance premiums, and that's continuing. I think it's over $15,000 a year now for an average premium for a family of four, and that doesn't count, the fact that with the deductibles, people are not infrequently having to kick in $5,000 to $10,000 more of their own before their coverage really starts to kick in. We're continuing to see that rise, and anticipate that will continue to rise. We don't really see any controls on that aspect right now.
And, of course, now we're in a presidential campaign where one of the leading candidates, Mitt Romney, is the author of a plan which in many ways was the model for the national scheme. What lessons can we learn from Romney Care before it goes national?
Yeah, so the national plan, as you said, is based on the plan that was begun in Massachusetts in 2006. We see a pretty similar outcome there to what's anticipated from the national. So in Massachusetts, they saw that about half of the people that were uninsured have now have insurance, and that's what the national program is expected to do, which means that when it's fully implemented, we'll still see 25 million or so people with no insurance at all. We've continued to see healthcare costs rise in Massachusetts, and people reporting that they're unable to afford to pay for necessary healthcare despite being insured. We saw a little bit of a decline in that initially after the legislation has passed, but since it has passed, those numbers of people saying that they have increased medical debt or are avoiding or delaying care due to the cost is increasing.
Yeah, the base plan it's not cheap, but it requires large copays, right?
That's right, and we know that copays become a financial barrier to care. The data is very clear on that no matter what your socioeconomic status is, if you have to pay for health care up front, it becomes an economic decision, and people are not able to determine between what health care is necessary and what is not necessary, so too often they avoid necessary care, which leads to greater problems down the road and more potentially expensive or worse outcome down the road because of that.
You mentioned that people in the 35 to 64 age group are especially finding health insurance especially expensive or difficult to get. But, when you get to be above 65, you kind of home free or close to it because you have Medicare. What is going on? It looks like that's going to be the pinata that everybody wants to hit to get the budget deficit down. What's the situation now with Medicare?
Yeah, again, it's very concerning. As you said, when people in this country reach 65 and they have Medicare, they don't have to worry about a health insurance problem. And we've seen very clearly that as a result of Medicare, that population has had a decline in the amount of poverty and that health outcomes start to improve once people reach the age of 65. Very concerning in this environment is that we have a Democratic president who is not ashamed to say in public that he's willing to cut our social insurance programs, including Medicare. And unfortunately, it's putting the blame on the wrong part of our healthcare system because the Medicare portion of our healthcare actually is rising at a rate, the costs are rising at a rate more slowly than our private-based portion of our healthcare. And the reason that the Medicare costs are rising is because we don't have a health system that controls costs overall. So overall, our healthcare costs are rising out of control, putting pressure on Medicare, but Medicare is getting blamed for it. We see language where the president is saying, well, we won't cut your benefits, but we think that's misleading because what they are planning to cut is reimbursement to physicians, and we know from the data that when physician reimbursement is cut, fewer physicians can see Medicare patients, and that does have the effect of decreasing access to care.
Of course, now people say, yeah, that's all true, but you look at the projections from the CBO, the inflation in Medicare costs over the coming decades, it will be enormous, and that's a mix of an aging population plus just relentless medical inflation. What is to be done?
Well, we've made this argument over and over, and I testified before the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform that what we need to do is not cut Medicare, but actually improve and expand Medicare to everybody. That would give us a national health system that would allow us to do rational health planning, how to use our resources to get the best health for our dollar. It would also allow us to have greater administrative simplicity. We would save over $400 billion a year with a single-payer national Medicare for all. And it would allow us to control our health care costs through various mechanisms. One obvious one that we should be doing, which is negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry for reasonable cost for our medications. We pay the most in this country of any of the industrialized nations for the same medications, and that just doesn't make sense.
I'm speaking with Margaret Flowers of the Physicians for a National Health Program. Does Medicare use its buying power now to get some degree of cost control?
Well, in terms of services, to some extent it does, but it's been prohibited from bargaining with the pharmaceutical industry for fair costs for the medications.
That's kind of shocking, how that happened and why.
Right. That really had to do with a piece of legislation. Billy Towson was responsible for that, and I believe he went from helping to pass that legislation to taking a very lucrative position with pharma, the lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry.
So it was just pure corporate lobbying and revolving door politics. There was nothing very high-minded behind it.
No, we see see that in pretty much every aspect right now in our country. You know, from the environment to healthcare to the finance industry, we see this revolving door politics and the policies being written to benefit the industries rather than the people.
There was a report that came out the other day showing that American physicians are very highly paid by world standards. Now, as a doctor yourself and a representative of an organization that's predominantly physicians, even have it in the name, what's your reaction to that?
Well, there's a great disparity of reimbursement to physicians in the United States. If you look at primary care physicians, they're really struggling, and we're losing our primary care practices. More and more of them are being bought up into these large corporate hospital, private corporations, because they can't make it independently, which is very sad, because it's not good for doctors when they lose their autonomy. It's not good for the patients. But then we have, you know, specialists that are making outrageous amounts of money, huge amounts, much higher than in other countries. This is kind of skewed. We have kind of a skewed proportion of doctors in this country. 70% are specialists and 30% are primary care. We would do much better if it was more of a 50-50 type of arrangement. But doctors in other countries are very comfortable. And if we think about it, they don't have to do things like pay off their medical school debt. They have very solid pensions and other benefits that doctors in this country don't have.
Republicans are always whining about the cost of malpractice insurance. How big a factor is that?
Well, malpractice insurance, you know, certainly is very expensive in the United States, but malpractice and the premiums are a very small percentage of our overall health costs, just a few percent. So that is often widely exaggerated. But again, this is something that a single-payer health system would address, because a large driver of malpractice is the cost of ongoing care after a bad outcome. And under a single-payer system, those costs of ongoing care would be guaranteed, and that would greatly reduce the number of people that would feel a need to sue.
Now, what about litigation as a way of disciplining incompetent doctors? Is it really an efficient way to go about it, or are there better ways to approach the problem?
You know, there are models that are much better ways. It takes a lot of resources to train a physician. And so a much more cost-effective way to deal with this problem is the way they do it in Canada, where if they find a physician that has a deficiency in some area or bad outcomes in a certain area, they put that physician on a program of really relearning or practicing under supervision until they feel like that physician is ready to practice independently again.
So we don't get the enormous settlements and expensive litigation under that kind of system.
Right. It's a much more common sense approach. It's let's figure out what the problem is. Let's remediate it and get that person back into practicing again.
Now, we've wandered from the budgetary pressures in Medicare, so let's go back to that for a moment. If the budget cutting comes not from limiting benefits, but from limiting reimbursement to healthcare providers, how does that work exactly?
Well, what we'll find then is that fewer and fewer healthcare providers will take Medicare patients, or we may find hospitals that are pressured to kick Medicare patients out of the hospital faster or not provide them perhaps the full care that they need. So it will really be, effectively, it will ration access to care and healthcare services.
And how does this play in Congress? Is this the kind of thing that Congress wants to hear and wants to do?
It's an interesting time in Congress. You know, the Republican Party is really all out, unabashedly saying that they want to get rid of our Medicare. They're calling it an entitlement program, and all sorts of misinformation out there around Medicare. What's unfortunate is that we're not seeing the Democratic Party take a strong stand against this and fight for it. So we're very concerned about this upcoming 2012 federal budget, which kicks in at the beginning of October, because it's allowing unlimited funding for military expenses, but all of the other expenses, necessary human services, are on the table to be chopped.
And it looks like this deficit commission, the super commission, which is due to report sometime around Thanksgiving or a little later, appropriately enough, is going to have Medicare in its crosshairs. Is that your understanding?
Yes, absolutely. This commission, this 12-person bipartisan commission, was created to come up with legislation that would be presented before the House and the Senate for an up or down vote. There's no allowance for amendments to this, so it's really concentrating the power in the hands of 12 people, six from the Senate and six from the House. And they're tasked with coming up with recommendations around Thanksgiving. As you said, this is a tactic that we see done frequently. We saw it last year with the National Deficit Commission, because Congress knows and the White House knows that around holiday time, people in America are not paying attention to what's going on in Washington, D.C. If that committee is not able to come up with sufficient recommendations by the time that they are required to, this will result in just as an automatic cut to Medicare.
The polls I've seen show that the public is not behind this agenda. People are not at all looking to take an axe to Social Security or Medicare, right?
Absolutely. We have super majorities in the polls of people in this country who want to protect our social insurance programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And I think it's important to remember that these are self-funded programs. These are all programs that are funded through taxes. They're really outside of the loop of the federal budget. They're not contributing to the deficit. So it's ludicrous to have these things even under discussion, but super majorities of people do oppose these cuts.
And you mentioned Medicaid. That, of course, being a program for poor people, probably doesn't have the broad support. What's the outlook for that?
Well, Medicaid is in crisis across the country. That's a health program that's funded at the state level with some federal funding. And as we know, all of our states are facing budget crises. And in many of the states, half or more of their deficit is due to Medicaid costs alone. Unfortunately, the Department of Health and Human Services has not been helpful in this regard, because they're allowing waivers to many of the states to allow them to cut their Medicaid rolls.
And finally, when Obamacare passed, it seemed that at least in mainstream discourse, the healthcare problem had been solved for now. Insofar as the single-payer agenda was ever on the public's radar, it kind of slipped off. What is the state of the single-payer movement now that this bill is, you know, this law is slated to take effect fully, I think, in 2014?
I was really optimistic about what happened during 2009, 2010 in terms of the single-payer movement, because we know that for decades we've had majority support for single-payer health care in the United States. And we really saw, despite the fact that leadership in Congress and the White House tried to keep single-payer out of the discussion, the single-payer movement across the country really grew and was creative and really tried to get out there. And that did not slow down, because we saw after the legislation passed that it failed to address the fundamental problems we have with healthcare in this country, that despite the fact that it was being called universal, affordable, and guaranteed, that it would be, in fact, none of those things. A lot of attention moved to the state level, and so we had over 20 states with single-payer legislation in some phase of the process. We saw Vermont was one of the ones that moved ahead the most, with actually passing a piece of legislation which could ultimately, if they're allowed to get the federal waivers they need, and there's continued public pressure in Vermont, could turn into a single-payer system. We do still have legislation in Congress. We have John Conyers' bill, H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, was reintroduced this year, and also Senator Sanders and Representative McDermott have companion bills in the House and the Senate, the American Health Security Act, and that's S-915 and H.R. 1200. Those were endorsed by the AFL-CIO this year, so that's some movement forward as well. But we've got to continue to educate, to organize and grow our numbers and put pressure on Congress to tell them that we want to not cut Medicare. It's not the problem. It's the solution. We need expanded and improved Medicare for all.
And these bills have not trivial numbers of co-sponsors, right?
Well, the House bill currently has... I was just in Congress yesterday. I think it has close to 70 co-sponsors at this point. The H.R. 676, in the past we've had as many as 100 co-sponsors, and that the number of co-sponsors is continuing to grow daily.
And while everybody pays attention to the Tea Party, their caucus in Congress has only about 70 members. So.
Right. The Congressional Progressive Caucus is actually the largest caucus in Congress. We would just hope that they would use that power that they have to advance a more progressive agenda.
And before we start recording, you were telling me about an October 2011 movement?
That's correct. The October 2011 movement, October2011.org, is a project that I'm involved in. It came about because so many of us who advocate for issues of social and economic justice found that we were running into the same obstacle, like that I saw during the health reform process. It was the industry that profits off of the current situation, that was writing the legislation, that was having the most influence over our members of Congress. And so each of us have been trying to work for and advocate for common sense, evidence-based solutions, but we don't get heard because the industry is in the way. The October 2011 movement brings these movements together under one broad-based social movement. We're going to be using all the tools in the toolbox. The standard tools are not working. Lobbying and emailing and electing officials are not working. So we'll be doing education, being engaged in civil resistance actions together, and pushing for common sense, evidence-based solutions to our 15 crises in this country. And people can learn more about that on our website, October2011.org.
I noticed that I was just reading earlier that there's an awful lot of discontent with the president among the labor movement and other progressive organizations. How does that feed into your work?
Well, I think more and more organizations are seeing that when you ally yourself with a political party, then your agenda, you know, becomes a political party's agenda. And we saw that during healthcare with so many progressive groups aligned with the president. And even as that health legislation got weaker and weaker, they continued to support it. And so now we've, you know, failed to address really pressing needs in this country. I mean, we have the highest rates of preventable deaths. We have the highest number of bankruptcies from medical costs. This is just unacceptable in a country that spends the most on health care already. So people are starting to realize that in order to be effective, we need to be independent of political parties. And I'm glad to see that labor and others are coming to that same conclusion.
That was Margaret Flowers of Physicians for a National Health Program. You can find the organization on the web at pnhp.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
In the morning, with his hand on his heart, to keep the world safe from falling apart. He pledges allegiance to the land of thrills. No one man wants to play there.
That was some of My Friend is a Stooge for the Media Priests by Per Ubu from 1995. That appellation applies to no one around here, of course, including, especially, my next guest, Maria Armudian. Aside from producing and hosting a show for our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles, Maria Armudian is the author of Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, just out from Prometheus Books. The messenger that she's slated for death is the existing media, which are generally not so helpful in the fate of the world. On bad days, I sometimes think that we make too much of the media, that it's superstructural fluff that distracts and confuses us while the real action is going on elsewhere. But I don't think that's really true, and Maria makes a strong case against my bad day feeling. Maria Armudian. Welcome, Maria. In your book, you review a whole bunch of cases in which the media contributed both to good and bad. More bad than good, I'm sorry to say. But let's start with one of the more egregious examples of horror in modern times, the massacres in Rwanda. Give us some background into how the battle got going and the role the media played in fomenting that.
Yeah, well, Rwanda, there's so much background that I actually should go into it that I probably won't have time for. But you know, these are a couple of ethnic groups. Some even don't think they're really ethnic groups because they're essentially the same people, same language, same religion, same culture. But they had, for the most part, been living together over many decades and centuries, had some divisions between them, partly as a result of European colonizers that had divided them. But for the most part, intermarrying, living together, going to school together, going to church together, working together. There was a rise of a very kind of extremist group. They called themselves the Hutu Power. And they had gone into government, and the Tutsis had for a long time been the main group in government. But they also took over the media. And in particular, one private radio station, privately held, called the RTLM. And it was a very hip radio station, had the best music, the best jokes, the best political commentary. Everybody tuned into it. And they began blaming the socioeconomic problems of Rwanda onto the Tutsis, blaming them for everything that was going badly there, whether it was the political problems or the economic problems. And then the plane was shot down that carried the president of Rwanda, and they also blamed the Tutsi population for that.
The entire population.
Well, they blamed the Tutsis, right. They characterized them, they kind of stereotyped them all into one category. They also pinpointed the rebel group quite a bit, too, that was in fact fighting, and that came out of a refugee group of Tutsis that had moved into neighboring countries. But they also categorized all Tutsis and made them sound like they were this complete, how should we call it, almost subhuman and evil group, and made it seem like, in their narrative, that in order to make Rwanda survive, in order to protect Rwanda, and to bring about these important qualities, these important causes like democracy, people were going to have to annihilate that race. They were invaders in this language. They were vermin in this language. There was even a section of one of the newspapers that said, if a Tutsi and a Hutu if they marry and have a child, they're going to have a monster kind of a baby, because it'll be this like Hydra-headed monster. And not everybody was convinced by these messages, of course, but there was a combination of military organization and neighbor-to-neighbor organization, and then people were repeatedly hearing this message and really nothing else, because there was no TV, literacy rates were pretty low, and a lot of people were convinced, a lot of people just got caught up in the frenzy, and then the handful of dissenters could not get a voice and could not get heard, so it became this kind of hegemonic message, so that within about 100 days, you saw 800,000 Tutsis killed in the most brutal and heinous ways, machetes, hammers, rocks, boiling water. It was really probably one of the ugliest chapters in the 20th century. But my point in the book is that it's not really just Rwanda, that there is this really awful possibility when extremists have hold of the media, when media are not in the hands of ethical, responsible journalists who can remain as neutral as possible, not that anybody can be completely neutral because we all have values, and can actually dissect sociopolitical issues in a way that people can understand them. So the three worst-case scenarios were Rwanda, the Bosnian War, and the Holocaust. In each of those cases, you saw this kind of homogenization of messages that targeted one group. Rwanda, of course, they even organized the genocide through the radio, where they told people where to find the hiding Tutsis and told people how to attack them and what weapons to use.
And got to the point where like people they're opening the morning radio broadcast by asking people if they've gotten to work killing yet, right?
Right, that became this euphemism. Have you started your work yet? And work became this euphemism for, you know, protecting your country, which was code for getting rid of the invaders.
Now, you also mentioned the Bosnia story. This is similar in that these were people who had lived together, different ethnic groups, but in some cases, they're not easy to tell apart. They'd intermarried. It had just been like day-to-day life. People had completely lived together in harmony, and then suddenly it all blew apart. What, did the media foment that as well?
Largely, yes. It was, again, the same kind of formula where you had the socio-political conditions were really difficult. You know, after Tito died, there was a lot. There was a rise of these national leaders, nationalist parties and leaders, Croatian, Serbian, Bosniak, and they started framing things in these nationalistic ways. At the same time, the economy was falling apart, and rather than people coming together and working together, the leaders had started this process of communicating their messages through the media and slowly taking over the media. The most successful in taking over media was Slobodan Milosevic, and you saw how he was able to change the narrative. So it started in Kosovo, where there had been this movement of Albanians for their own republic in Yugoslavia, and he was able to change the narrative in such a way that it was purely about this is an injustice to Serbs because Kosovo belongs to us. They are the invaders. They're raping and killing our people. And sometimes there was a rape. Sometimes there was a murder. But you saw a casting upon the entire Kosovo Albanians that it was all of them doing it. It wasn't a single rape or a single murder that was occurring. And this happened every time something negative would occur. They would cast blame upon the entire Albanians. And then the other very important thing in all genocidal narratives is this, they're going to annihilate us if we don't annihilate them first. And this is very common in all three of those worst-case scenarios.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that the Germans, I hadn't known this before, the Nazis were talking up an obscure book by an obscure American about how the mission was to sterilize the Germans and wipe them out within two generations.
And they used that as well. But the bigger narrative in Nazi Germany was it was an international Jewish conspiracy that was going to annihilate the Germans. And there was the pseudoscientific line about eugenics. And Hitler really believed that there certain people were just evil or bad or subhuman because they were of mixed blood. And people began to start researching this. Even in the academy, in the world of the universities, you saw scientists and doctors actually trying to test eugenics theories. It became this, again, hegemonic narrative, led by a leader, then propagated and disseminated through mass media.
And it was a process of many years before World War II started. They were whipping the population into a frenzy, right?
Yeah, I would say less of a frenzy in Nazi Germany than it was in the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, and more of this gradual assimilation and taking legal action. See, it's always kind of more than one thing happening at once. The media come in and they make this narrative, and then you have the law come in and, so they have these laws that defined what a Jew was. What is a Jew? Well, they came up with a formula, and then they started isolating Jews, and then the media came in again with another narrative. Now, I'd like to set that aside and then talk about the good stuff.
Yeah, I was just about to shift to that, I should say. I'm speaking with Maria Armudian, who is the author of Kill the Messenger, just out from Prometheus Books. But in the Rwanda case, you tell a story of how things turned out somewhat differently in neighboring Burundi. How were things a little different in Burundi?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories. So Burundi, as most people might know, used to be part of Rwanda. So you've got kind of the same two ethnic groups and the same similar dynamics, slightly different power structures, but they're still identifying in this way. You're either Hutu or you're Tutsi, you're either with us or against us. And they had some extremist media also. You had government media, you had, the rebellion media. But what happened in Burundi is, first of all, they did not have a single RTLM that was kind of this hegemonic message. But then all these nonprofit organizations, European and American, went in and set up a studio called Ijambo, where they trained journalists on how to get underneath the propaganda of both the government and the rebel groups. And one of the ways they had to verify every story that they did is that a Hutu and a Tutsi had to go in together and had to agree on the facts, and then it had to be verified by a third person. So they got to the point where when officials would give them statements, they'd toss them out and say, "We're not going to say this over the air. It's just not true." And that was something that started to develop trust with the Burundian population. They also started doing radio shows where they would have experts on and community members call in with their own stories, so that it generated this understanding about both social psychology, group psychology, so people understood why the war was going on, as well as the economic reasons for the war and the power struggles that were going on. And they started to shed this kind of us and them dichotomy and start to see themselves as Burundians who had a common plight. And that was a very, very important part of the shift there. So you still saw a lot of killing. It wasn't, you know, I think there was something like 250,000 people that were still killed. But it started to go the other way. And this just started with like an hour a day on the radio and developed into additional media as it went on.
And you also tell the story of coming down from the troubles in Northern Ireland in the 90s. So what was the media contribution there?
Boy, Northern Ireland was, it's one of these very complex situations where you had a very divided media. You had the Irish Republicans having their own media. You had the Irish nationalist Catholics that were not of the Republican ideology, which were the ones that the IRA were affiliated with their media. Then you had the Protestants with their own media. So it started out very divided, but it allowed people to hear each other's viewpoints a little bit. But more than that, there were two or three things going on. One is that the mainstream journalists kept trying to understand why the violence was occurring. And they went to extreme lengths to find out. I tell a story of a couple of journalists I interviewed while I was there, of when they went to go talk to the IRA. Now, the British government tried to silence the IRA. They had a broadcasting ban. Journalists were not allowed to air the voices of terrorists. And yet the journalists found ways around it. In this one case I was talking about, journalists would go to meet with the IRA, and they weren't allowed to see who they were. They were masked. So they'd blindfold the journalists, drive them to an undisclosed location, explain their point of view, drive them back, and drop them off. So they just dug into each of these paramilitaries, and there were paramilitaries on both sides. The second thing, a lot of the BBC journalists did not like being hamstrung by the government. And so they read the letter of the law but didn't follow the spirit of the law. So they said, okay, we can't air the voices of terrorists, so-called terrorists, but we can at least show their faces and have somebody else read their words. At a certain point, they got it to an almost perfect lip sync with Gerry Adams, who is now and has been for a long time a member of parliament, but he wasn't allowed to have his voice on the BBC because he was classified as a terrorist. And so here they'd show his face, and instead of hearing his voice, you'd hear an actor lip-syncing.
Margaret Thatcher was not pleased.
Not at all. And then I think there are two other factors. One is journalists are generally trained to look for conflict and to report on conflict, but they actually looked for a peace narrative too. And when there was common ground and when there was a possibility of reporting on agreement, they didn't always frame things as conflict. And they allowed people who were classified as terrorists by the government to actually transform themselves when they did. So people who were in prison for murder, when they actually decided to help organize the peace, journalists didn't leave them in that stereotypical, oh, well, they're terrorists. They allowed them to transform themselves into peace leaders. And a lot of these paramilitary leaders became leaders of the peace. It was actually quite profound.
Now here in this country, we see, not as extreme as a wartime situation of the sort you're talking about, but we do see a lot of frenzy being whipped up against Muslims, for example. The stereotyping, the dehumanization, the driving of the population into a frenzy. What is your perspective on that?
I think there are several things. One is it's Muslims and immigrants that I hear the most kind of slur towards. And there are a few things that I think I'd say about that. One is, it's again trying to stereotype an entire group of people into one little category based upon the act of maybe a single person. So when one single person may deliver something that society doesn't like, and then you throw an entire population into a category, that's just inaccurate, and it's not journalism. It's not journalism at all. Journalism would try to parse it out and not try to group people all as one.
But for the point of view of a profit-driven media, it sells papers and hauls in the eyeballs.
Right, right. So at the end of the book, I talk about the constraints on journalism, and there are all these different kinds of constraints. There are constraints when you have a government-sponsored media. You have constraints when the government doesn't want something, like in the case of the BBC. But when you have a profit-driven media, you have another set of constraints, and you can't really do intellectual kinds of reporting if you fear you're going to lose audience, and that's a problem. So these two models on their own are sometimes not the best models. I mean, the government model can do a little bit more as long as it's not reporting on itself. Al Jazeera is a case of this too, where it's great on a lot of issues, but it can't cover Qatar. Qatar, which owns Al Jazeera, essentially said, yeah, report on anything but us. So these are kind of the constraints that we're dealing with in trying to create a media that is truly in service of humanity.
Now, at the end of the book, you argue for a kind of healing role for the media, the kinds of explorations you're talking about, the kinds of explorations of the other, developing mutual understanding. I think a lot of more traditional journalists would look at that and say that's just another form of propaganda. You have bad propaganda on the one hand, whipping up tensions, and then you have this sort of good model of propaganda to bring peace. And really, the mission of the journalist should be just to report facts and not take opinions. What do you say to that?
Now, here's what I say to that. First of all, there is no just fact reporting journalism, right? All reporting is framed in a particular way, and as scholars have said, facts don't frame themselves. It's not just the facts. It's the way that you put them into a story and the way that you put them in a context that matters. So, for example, I was talking about the Ireland situation, where you can either report on the conflict all the time and all the disagreements, which may be a small fraction of what's going on, or you can report on the bigger context, in which conflict is a small piece of it, but there's much more agreement. This is one example of, I'm not advocating for people to change the facts. I'm advocating for people to be accurate and to really think about their frames and where they come from. Journalists in the United States are also trained, or had been for years, it's changing now, for years been trained to be moderate in their ideology and to keep the extremes out. And that is in itself an ideology. That's changing now, as we're seeing that both the left and the right are kind of polarizing themselves in media as well. And then the final thing is, even in the West, journalism has this, journalists are trained to report on things that are like a violation of values. So it's an awful thing when X occurs, and so they report on that. But that's not neutral either. Choosing the stories and choosing the sources and choosing the framing, that's very different than being completely neutral. You have to make these choices, and they come from our culture, they come from our training, they come from the reward system, they come from the constraints of the structure of media.
To close, I mean, let's talk about the institutional arrangements here in the United States and what we might be able to do about it. We both do programming for a very tiny network which we're supposed to promote. It's part of the charter to promote understanding between people and promote the ideal of peace. But you know, we're small and can barely pay the bills, whereas we've got, you know, Rupert Murdoch's got any number of outlets, and most notoriously Fox, and it's not likely that that's going to be taken away from him. So what do you suggest we think about or work towards as a way of coming up with a more constructive media environment?
Right. Well, you know, I talk about all these different models in the back of Kill the Messenger. So one of the things I'm really convinced of is that when journalists own the media themselves, it can change drastically what they can put out. There were a couple of models in the book of this. One was in Mexico. In Mexico, it was a co-op where journalists ran the newspaper. It wasn't just the journalists that owned it, but the workers owned it, including the journalists. Uno Mas Uno was one of them. And when the government would try to dictate, and for the most part they were able to dictate what media would report on in the framing of the media, the journalists in most of the other networks and newspapers would follow, but not in the journalist-owned one. So that's one model. And then they can decide where the lines are to how to fund it in such a way that they can continue to be effective. Now, one of the problems of Pacifica, that you and where you and I work, is that the technology is changing so quickly that listeners are not necessarily always listening in real time, and Pacifica is not keeping up with the 21st century. We're not using the new technologies in a way that will be able to keep our listener sponsorship alive and awake and engaged and supportive. That is making our funds dwindle to a massive degree. That's one problem. We could go through a whole litany of them, but that's, I think, one of the main ones that Pacifica needs to address. There are other models, too, that you can see on the Internet that are starting to work and to flourish. Some of them are the nonprofit models. You know, we're seeing ProPublica and these kinds of investigative organizations starting to emerge and to flourish and to be able to do good work. And I think institutions are going to be another place that we can look to have joint partnerships with universities and even an inter-university kind of media where you can report on the best material that comes out of the university and make sense of the news in a way that's deeper so that people understand politics beyond the news. Sounds like somebody's radio show.
And a little less of the Sean Hannity model of things. Okay, well, thank you very much, Maria. That was Maria Armudian, host of the Scholar's Circle and the Insiders on our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles, and author of Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, just out from Prometheus Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the second movement of Brahms' Piano Sonata No. 3, performed by Murray Pariah. Brahms was all of 20 when he wrote this. Sometimes I think that my taste for Brahms is a symptom of progeria, so it's nice to be reminded that he wrote something this spectacular at such a tender age. Till next week, bye.